You are listening to the podcast of Providence Church in Austin, Texas. We hope this message raises your affections for Jesus and helps you live out the gospel in everyday life.
If you haven't been with us, we have been working our way for a while now through this letter of 1 Corinthians. And for the last several weeks, we've been in a section of the letter that deals specifically with the use of spiritual gifts in the worship of the church. In their case, really what we're dealing with is the misuse of spiritual gifts in worship. They had come to elevate certain gifts above others. And these more impressive, important gifts became like a mark of spiritual maturity or power in their community. And so then they also became a source of division and jealousy in their community. So in chapter 12, Paul sort of levels the playing field by reminding them that, look, all of the gifts come from the same Spirit, and the purpose of all of them is for the common good, not for our own selfish gain. And then in chapter 13, he sets forth the priority of love. Love is a way of life in which all of the gifts find their real purpose and power. And now in chapter 14, he brings both of these things together, gifts and love. He brings them together and he begins to work out some specific application for how they should approach and participate in gathered worship. And so what we're gonna do is we're gonna look at the specific issue that he's addressing in Corinth, and then we're gonna try to connect some of the dots to our church, how we should think about approaching and participating in gathered worship. But I wanna start by reflecting on an experience I had almost 30 years ago. I was a college student, I was a new Christian, and the thing that was most compelling to me in my new Christian life was just the reality of God. I had like believed in God in some general ways, but when it sunk in that he was real, like that he was present with us and involved in everyday stuff, I wanted nothing more than to experience that just in every way that I could. And so about a year into my Christian life, I heard of a revival that was happening in Florida. I honestly didn't even know what that meant. It just sounded to me like God was doing something unusual, something powerful, and I wanted to see it. Like I wanted to experience it. So a group of friends and I made the 10-hour drive to attend a worship service. That's how you know God's at work. College dudes drive 10 hours to go to church. And so we went to this evening service, and yeah, it was unusual. You know, at least for me it was. It was like several hours long. It was super intense. There's a lot of emotions going on, and I didn't know how to process that. I mean, imagine me then, as you know me now. And at the end of the service, a team of ministers came into the congregation and started praying for people, and like people were falling over. Like hundreds of people falling over everywhere. If you've ever seen anything like that on TV, it was exactly like that. If you have a hard time imagining me in that setting, then you can imagine how weird it is for me to share that story with you. I've held it for 13 years, and here it is. But the reason I share it is because I kind of want to reflect on it a little bit. So as I look back on that, there was something good going on. There was something in me that genuinely wanted just to experience God's presence. The problem was, as I did it in a pretty self-seeking way, it was kind of just about me. It was some sort of like Christian version of thrill-seeking. And I think that's the dynamic that's happening in Corinth. There are people that genuinely want to experience God's presence and power, but for them, that takes the form of seeking these heightened religious experiences, these gifts that feel spectacular. That's why they were drawn to that set of gifts, things like knowledge and wisdom, miracles and healing, prophecy and tongues. Those are the gifts that Paul lists in chapter 12 because those are the things that have their attention. Those are the things that are center stage at the church in Corinth. Now, Paul doesn't dismiss those gifts. He says he wants everyone to have them. He doesn't dismiss personal spiritual experiences. He wants everyone to have that too. His point here is that in gathered worship, those things aren't the focus. The focus is exalting Jesus and building up his body. And so throughout this chapter, there's this tension I think that we all feel between a desire for like personal experiences of God, and then also this concern for like corporate church health, building up the community. And they're not at odds with each other. In fact, Paul wants to bring them together. And so I just want us to see three things in this passage that I think help us have a more holistic view of how we approach and participate in worship. And the three things are these. You should write them down now because I'm no guarantee I'm going to say them again, but desire, aim, like our intention, our goal, and wholeness. I think these are the three concepts Paul's using to bring this tension, resolve this tension for us. Let's look at the first thing, desire. 1 Corinthians 14, verse 1. Pursue love and earnestly desire the spiritual gifts. All right, so pursue love. That's the priority. He's already established that. Love is a way of life that all of the gifts find their true meaning and purpose and power. But I want you to notice that the pursuit of love does not diminish our desire for the gifts. He says, earnestly desire the spiritual gifts. Do both of these things. Pursue love, desire the gifts. And that word, the word that's used for spiritual gifts here in this verse is actually a more general word that just means the spirituals. Pursue the spirituals. One commentator defines it as stuff the Spirit does. That's my favorite kind of commentary. Just put it right down here for me. I like that. Stuff the Spirit does. So we like to think about spiritual gifts and we like to kind of figure out what ours are as if it's some sort of personality profile. And I think Paul more generally is just urging us to like seek the things of the Spirit, to want to get in on what the Spirit is doing, to pray for it, to desire it, to long for it. These words, pursue and desire, they're very strong words. In other contexts, they're used to describe persecution, people fleeing a city. They're used to describe intense striving, even like to burn with envy, right? Strong words. These are emotional words. They have to do with our longings. This is about what you're chasing in life. And man, I love the idea of being a church that's chasing and that is marked by stuff the Spirit does. Not too long ago, I posed a question to you in a letter that 38% of you read. And because MailChimp tells me that. So, and the question was this, what do we want? What do we desire when we come to church? You know, when we go to a comedy show, we go wanting to laugh. There's an expectation there. When we go on vacation, we go wanting to relax. So when we go places, we have a desire, we have an expectation. So what is it here? What do you want when you come to church? I'll tell you what I want, and this is in my best moments. In my best moments, when I come to church, I want to be convinced again anew that God is real, present with us and for us. I want to be captivated by the beauty of Jesus. I mean, all of it. His humility in coming to us, his perfect life of love and righteousness, his death, his sacrificial death, in our place, for us, for our sin. The victory of his resurrection, victory over sin and death. I even want to think about his ascension. We forget that sometimes. I want to think about him ascending on high to the right hand of the throne of God where he's the king. And from where he sends his Spirit to indwell and lead his people, I want to be immersed in that whole story of the gospel. I want to hear it and feel it and sing it in song, in the liturgy, in the preached word, at the table, in the bread, in the wine. I want to think about all of that. I want to be captivated by it. I want to see the Spirit at work at church. Like, I don't want to just come and passively take it in. I want to see God doing stuff. I want to see the Spirit convicting us of sin, challenging the way that we think about things, comforting people who need comfort, compelling us as a community toward action. I want to be reminded how much I love being a part of this community. Like when I see people serving, I want to remember that. When I hear you singing, when we come to the table together, just in all of the little ways that we minister to one another in a gathering like this, I want to be reminded of how great that is. That's all. That's all I want. Now look, I can't actually make any of that happen, but I can want it. I can ask God for it. I can open myself up to it. And I think that's what Paul is urging us to do. Sometimes my desire for these things are really strong and sometimes they wane. It is easy for me during the course of a week to find myself pursuing a life of comfort or pleasure or security and just sort of treating God as an accessory to all of that. That's not hard. And so that's why we need this. One of the functions of the gathered worship is to renew us and strengthen us in our faith. That's why you get commands like you see in Hebrews 10. He says, let's consider, like let's think hard about this, how we might stir up one another to love and good works, not neglecting to meet together, as is the habit of those people who take spring break off, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day drawing near. So the place where we stir one another up and encourage one another is here, when we meet together. And so it's not just that we should prioritize being here, that's step one, but we should be here with a certain level of expectancy. We should be here expecting the Lord to use us in each other's lives, to stir up, to encourage, to build one another up in the faith. Right, that gets us to the second word here, which is aim. That phrase, building up the church, that occurs five times in this passage, which you'll see. It's the main exhortation in the passage. It's the main idea. And that is Paul saying, like, look, you've got all this zeal for the gifts. Great. Now let's aim that zeal. Let's redirect that zeal to building up the church. That's the aim. Pick up in verse 1. Pursue, love, earnestly desire the gifts. And then he says, especially that you may prophesy. Right here, he is bringing into focus. He's highlighting the aim of building up the church. The main contrast in this chapter is between two specific gifts. He's really narrowing the conversation to prophecy and tongues. All right, prophecy, because I know you don't know what either of those are. Prophecy is simply receiving a message from God that you then communicate to someone else. And that message connects with them. It clarifies something specific in their life that they're thinking about or they're going through. It's a present word from God for someone's present moment. Sometimes we think of Old Testament prophecy, which is usually more about telling the future. That's not the case in the New Testament. The New Testament is a word for the present. Tongues is speaking an utterance in a language that's unknown to the one speaking. It could be a known human language that I just don't know that I'm speaking. I've been around that before. But it can also be not a known human language, what Paul refers to as the tongues of angels. It's still meaningful content. It's just only God knows what it is, what it means. And so in this sense, and I think this is primarily what we're looking at in 1 Corinthians 14, tongues is used in personal praise and prayer to God. These are both speaking gifts. That's what they're enamored with. That's what Paul's addressing. The verb to speak occurs 24 times in this chapter. That's what we're talking about. So a very simple way to think about these two things is tongues is speaking to God and prophecy is speaking to people. Now in Corinth, it seems that they were drawn really to the phenomena of tongues, which is fine. But in the context of worship, Paul is saying, I would rather you be drawn to prophecy because it's better. How is it better? Well, it's better because it builds up the church. Look at verse 2. One who speaks in a tongue speaks not to men, but to God. For no one understands him, but he utters mysteries in the spirit. So just to be clear, Paul's not disparaging tongues. He's just saying that in the context of worship, they're not as helpful. Later, Paul will say, I speak in tongues more than everybody. And I wish all of you did. Like, so he's not against it. He's against it in this context because prophecy is more helpful. Verse 3, on the other hand, the one who prophesies speaks to people and their upbuilding, encouragement, and consolation. So prophecy is helpful because it's speaking a word from God that builds others up in their faith. It gives us three little examples here, functions of prophecy. It's not exhaustive, but it builds up, it encourages, it consoles. That word build up is a construction term. It's used in the Bible often to talk about as a metaphor for maturity and growth. Many times it's connected to speaking truth and teaching within the church. That's the primary way we grow up in the faith. These words, encouragement and consolation, are very similar words. The idea behind both of them is just coming alongside someone to help them. And sometimes that can take the form of exhorting. Sometimes it takes the form of comforting. The gift of prophecy speaks to a wide variety of situations. Now, that all sounds pretty normal, doesn't it? Like, we speak words all the time to each other that build up and encourage and comfort. So what's the difference between that everyday stuff and prophecy? Well, in a very general sense, there's not a lot of difference. I think anytime we're speaking words that build others up in the faith, we're like in the realm of prophecy. In a narrower sense, though, prophecy does have some distinctives. One distinctive is that it's usually a spontaneous word. Like, it's not something that I already knew that I'm just now sharing with you. It's something that comes to me in the moment to share with you. And usually it relates to a very specific thing in the person's life. It may not be a thing that I even know about. I may not even know how it's connecting, but they do. They sense God speaking directly to them through the prophetic word. And this kind of thing, I think, can happen in various ways. It happens in preaching sometimes. So generally speaking, I kind of think about what I'm going to say when I get up here. Trust me, you know? I write some stuff down. But I also might say some things that I didn't think about. Sometimes that's just nervous energy coming out, me filling gaps and stuff while I find my place. But sometimes it's a prompting of the Spirit. Sometimes it's God bringing specific words to mind that I just say. I don't even know what they're for. And then sure enough, someone will tell me after the service, that phrase, which felt sort of secondhand to me, that connected with me, and here's how. And it was a prophetic word for that person. Be encouraged by that. There are moments in the sermon where you might be utterly bored, but God is speaking to somebody. You just want to join together and celebrate that together. It also happens interpersonally, and I think often it might just, you know, you might sense God is putting something on your heart, something on your mind to speak to someone else. Sometimes it's just as simple as a verse that God brings to mind that you would share with someone else. All right, worst case scenario, you're just encouraging, strengthening people. But it might be a prophetic word. Even just a verse might connect with somebody so specifically, so timely, in ways that you couldn't even know, and they will sense God speaking directly to them through you. I think it's possible for this kind of thing to happen often without us even knowing that that's what's happening, and that would be okay. It'll be okay. One time before a sermon, I plead with God to please do something. So I'm on the front row and I'm praying. And on this particular day, this was back in Central Christian, I was desperate. I felt real awful about the sermon I was about to give. And that's a hard place to be because you still have to get up and give it. You have to go through all that. And I was just like, man, this is gonna be awful. I'm gonna look stupid and this is terrible. I didn't wanna do it. But you have to do it. So I'm praying that God would just, in spite of me, have mercy on us and use it. And I'm asking God, and I don't even know what to pray. That's how lost I am. And so I'm asking God, help me pray for this sermon. And I uttered this prayer that it would be refreshing to people. I have never prayed that for a sermon. In the moment, I thought that was weird. It felt like a word that God had given me to pray for the sermon. Okay, I get up, sludge through the thing. I go back to my seat, and I'm feeling no better than I did in the beginning. Worse, actually. Only better because it was done. And a woman in our church walks up to me and says, Will, thank you for that. That was so refreshing. I felt better. Right? A prophetic word to encourage this poor pastor. I think it happens in just everyday conversations like that. Maybe in ways we don't even know. Here's the thing, though. It happens in the context of ministry. I don't find it to be normative that God takes some person who's isolated and disconnected from the body and not engaged in ministry and is like, hey, I'm gonna give you a prophetic word for somebody. I think that person is dangerous. What I do see is that people who are engaged, people who are in community, seeking to serve one another, asking God to use them, we get in those moments and we find out we don't actually know what to do. We don't actually know what to say. We need God. And it's in those places, at those points of contact, that the Spirit of God and the gifts of the Spirit come alive. You gotta be engaged. I experienced this in a really, really powerful way when I was young in the faith. I was doing campus ministry here at UT. I took a group of students to New York City. And if you want to experience need for God, get in the middle of New York City. And so we had this thing. We were in Grand Central Station subway station. And our task was to hold these signs that said free prayer. All right, when the guy was telling us to do this, I was like, hey man, does this work? He was like, yes. I was like, how though? I don't see it. I think we're just gonna look like stupid Texans thinking that New Yorkers are gonna stop and pray with us. He was like, yes, that's exactly what you're gonna look like and it's gonna work. So we do it. We go in subway station, we're just holding these signs, free prayer. And I'm so skeptical. I'm so just like, whatever. And yet, strangers, people are coming up to us. Some people walk past us and turn around and come back to us and ask us to pray. There actually formed a line of people who wanted strangers to pray for them. I couldn't believe it. Well, in one of the prayer times, this woman had come and she had asked us to pray for her sister who was having a hard time. That's all she said. My sister's having a hard time. Okay, so we start praying. And we're praying and I'm just like, I don't actually know what to pray. I should have asked her some follow-up questions. Like, what's the nature of the hard time? What's going on here? So I didn't. And so I'm just asking the Lord, hey, would you help me pray for this woman? I'm over caring about myself at this point. I just wanna be of help to her. How can I pray for her? And so these words start coming out where I begin to pray for a restored communication with her and her sister. And I was like, man, that feels presumptive. I don't actually know that that's an issue. But as I prayed that, she began to weep. And we talked afterward, and that was the burden she was carrying. She had this estranged relationship with her sister, hadn't talked to her, wanted God to restore it. And you know what she felt that day? She did not think, man, that guy's impressive. That's not what she felt. That's not what it's about. What she felt was that in the middle of this huge city and in the middle of this busy subway station, that God saw her, knew her burdens, and wanted to carry it for her. That's pretty powerful. I'm glad I didn't think twice about just what God was telling me to pray. I had another situation in that subway station. I should go back there. But I had prayed for a guy, not eventful. And then after we were done, he looked at me and he said, hey, thank you. I'll be praying for the church that you lead. And I was like, no. I do campus ministry. I'm just here with some college students. He's like, I know, but you're gonna be a pastor. I was like, No, I had never once thought about that possibility in my entire life. And I was like, you don't understand. I do college ministry. He's like, I know, but he was just super calm about it. He's like, I know, but you're gonna be a pastor and I'll pray for your church. Okay, buddy, thank you, have a good day. And so I thought nothing of it and I never thought of that guy again, actually. It didn't affect me in any way. Until years later, when God was calling us to plant Providence, but I was still in the process of trying to discern that, trying to figure out, Lord, do you really want me to do this? And one day I was out in front of my house in Omaha and I was praying and that guy's face popped in my head and those words. What's weird about it is the face looked like Gus Fring from Breaking Bad. What if it was Gus? Hey, if I got a prophetic word from like Mr. Pollo Hermano himself, I feel really good about that. I don't know if it was him or not, but that just popped in my head. And in that moment, it felt so assuring. It felt like God was saying, like, yeah, I've been preparing you this for a long time. Let's do this. All right, look, I'm not an expert. That's all my experiences in total, okay? I'm just trying to give you some examples of how this gift can be really helpful in building up the church and really normal. I've been around the misuse of this gift and I know how destructive that can be. And so there's a lot of discernment and humility involved in this. We shouldn't be brazen about it. Paul's main point here is not that everyone should do this all of the time. It's not even that prophecy is like the key to a healthy church. Here, he's just trying to redirect their zeal for certain gifts to an aim of building up the church. And prophecy is a great example of that in contrast to tongues. And so look what he says, verse 4. The one who speaks in tongues builds himself up, but the one who prophesies builds up the church. Verse 5. The one who prophesies is greater than the one who speaks in tongues unless someone interprets so that the church may be built up. So with tongues, there is the possibility of someone interpreting the message. And in that case, it basically functions like prophecy. It builds people up. Verse 6. Now, brothers, if I come to you speaking in tongues, right, that would be kind of cool, right? The Apostle Paul shows up. He's speaking some angelic language. But what he's saying is it won't benefit you unless I bring you some revelation or knowledge or prophecy or teaching. He's saying, if I come to you, what would really benefit you is if I taught you, if I spoke truth to you. This is why in gathered worship, prophecy is better than tongues. In verses 7 through 11, then, Paul just offers a series of illustrations. We're going to look at them really briefly. He's just driving his point home. Verse 7. Even if lifeless instruments, such as the flute or the harp, do not give distinct notes, how will anyone know what is being played? So the illustration is about intelligibility. Like if I just bang on a piano with all kinds of stuff, sounds will be coming out, but it will not be intelligible. It will not sound like music. It'll grate. It won't be helpful at all. If I play like correct notes in relationship to each other, I play like Mozart or something, that will sound good. That will be helpful. It'll be beneficial. You could also think of like an orchestra. You could have all the members of an orchestra playing actual music, but if it's different, if it's dissonant, it'll sound crazy. And so in a corporate sense, when we play music, we play correct notes, we play intelligible notes, and we play it in concert with one another so that everyone benefits. Verse 8, if the bugle gives an indistinct sound, who will get ready for battle? So the bugle is an instrument as well, but here he's talking about, you know, the bugle conveys a message. You hear the bugle and you know, I need to prepare for battle. And I think in the same way, if the gospel is not proclaimed with clarity, we will not understand what Jesus said, that the kingdom of God is at hand, is among us. And it solicits some kind of preparation and action and response on our part. Verse 10, another illustration. There are doubtless many different languages in the world and none is without meaning. But if I do not know the meaning of the language, I'll be a foreigner to the speaker and the speaker a foreigner to me. So just put yourself in some situation where no one speaks English and you only speak English and imagine how you feel there. Lost, helpless, confused. That's what Paul's saying is if we just gather together and we speak unknown languages, we utter in tongues, we're gonna feel lost and confused. There's maybe other implications for us, which are, you know, the language we use when we're together in worship or in gospel communities, is it intelligible to everyone? Is it accessible to people who aren't familiar with that language? Or are we just doing the Christian babble thing and people feel like a little bit lost? It's just one implication of that. Here's Paul's main point, driving home verse 12. So with yourselves, here's all these illustrations, and so with you, since you're eager for the manifestations of the Spirit, great, strive to excel in using them to build up the church. So like if we want to excel in this area, I think the first step for us is just to desire it. To want and expect God to work in these ways. So if God brings something to mind that you feel like you want to speak to another person, let's lean into that. Let's do it with humility. But let's do it and let's expect God to use it in some way. The reason we do it with humility is because prophecy doesn't carry the same authority as scripture. We'll see next week. Prophecy has to be examined and weighed in community before it's accepted. So do not say things like, God is saying to you, and then say something. Do not say, I have a word from the Lord for you. That is to import authority and weight that prophecy doesn't have. It puts people in a really awkward position. That's the main misuse of prophecy. What if you tell me something that's from the Lord and I know a fact that it ain't? One of us is crazy, you know? That's the position it puts you in. Just speak the message. Just tell the person humbly, God might be saying something to them. If it's from the Lord, they'll know it. If it's not, they'll just think you're weird. And that's okay. We can give each other space to grow, to try, to submit to God in all of these things. What's important in the church, one commentator summarizes, is that we have space to share what the Spirit has put on our hearts for the benefit of others. We have space to share what the Spirit has put on our hearts for the benefit of others. That can happen here. I think one of the primary areas that happens in our church is in our small groups, in our gospel communities. I lead a gospel community. I know what this is like. Usually, the leader asks questions and people respond to the leader, and there's like 8 or 9, these kinds of conversations. That's fine. When a gospel community gets really fun and good is when people start talking to each other, though. Right? When someone shares something that's going on in their life, and someone, the leader's not just thinking about how to get to the next question, they leave some space, and someone else listens to that and moves into it, speaking a word of truth, asking a question, praying for that. But when that kind of stuff happens, then I think you begin to see this dynamic at work, where God uses you to speak a word into someone's life that builds them up. Anytime we do anything like that, we're in the realm of prophecy. And there may be specific times where it's more poignant, where it connects at a very deep level for someone. I don't think we need to be overly concerned about the difference between the two. It's all stuff the Spirit does, and I think we should just desire it and lean into it. All right, here's the last thing. So there's desiring the work of the Spirit, there's aiming for that work to be building others up, and then there's wholeness. Verse 13. Therefore, one who speaks in a tongue should pray that he may interpret. For if I pray in a tongue, my spirit prays, but my mind is unfruitful. What am I to do? I'll pray with my spirit, but I will pray with my mind also. I'll sing praise with my spirit, but I'll sing with my mind also. We do not have time to get into all the details here, but the big picture is that he's exhorting them and us to approach worship in a holistic way. We should not treat worship purely as a sensational experience, like where our bodies, spirits, emotions are engaged, but our minds are not. Nor should we treat worship as a purely intellectual exercise, where our minds are engaged, but our bodies and our spirits are not. Holistic worship involves body, mind, spirit, all working together. We need all of it. But we tend toward one, and we're usually a little skeptical of the other. All right, so if you live in your head, and that's the primary way you engage this service, anything that's like emotionally driven feels a little out of bounds, uncomfortable, maybe even manipulative to you, you're skeptical of that. If the primary way you engage in worship is some sort of like inner, just like emotional engagement, which is good, then things like doctrine or like reciting professions of faith together, that feels a little bit lifeless to you. And we just need to acknowledge these preferences, these bents that we have, and say, Lord, would you give us all of it? Would you help me grow in the areas that I'm weak and use the people in the room to help me do that? We need all of it. If you just read the Psalms, just a cursory reading of the Psalms will tell you this is what worship is meant to be. One quick example, Psalm 63. This is everywhere in the Psalms, but here's one. He says, I've looked upon you in the sanctuary, right? I've contemplated you, thought about who you are, I've observed, beholding your power and glory. All right, so this has moved into some level of awe, appreciation. There's some emotional engagement here. I'm beholding something beautiful. And then he says, as a result, my lips will praise you. I will lift my hands to you. You see, there's a physical, bodily response to the mind and the emotion, to the things that are going on internally. This happens all the time in the Psalms. There are other Psalms of lament and grief and desperation, and there are corresponding groans and postures that match those realities. One of the things I love about our liturgy is I think it gives a variety of ways to hear truth, to engage our minds in different forms. And I think it gives space to respond in a variety of ways. Like when we read a confession or profession together, we're responding as a body, building one another up. We have time personally to confess sin. That's usually my favorite moment of the service because I like to engage at that level. We have lots of content. I don't need to tell you that. There's lots of things to think about in our service. And I think what the Lord would like to do is to bring all of that together in our experience, individually and corporately. You can obviously just go through the motions and none of it will mean anything to you. I mean, you can do that. But you can also try to engage it holistically, mind, body, spirit. Doing any of these things, lifting our hands, praying for one another, doing any of that isn't a mark of spiritual maturity or power or closeness to God. It's just an opportunity to engage with our whole being. I don't know what the Lord is speaking to you today in these categories. Maybe it's the desire thing. Maybe you just feel this apathy and just a longing for him to stir up some desire for the things of the Spirit. Could be the aim. It might have occurred to you that, you know what, I just come here as a consumer, I take it in, I'm only thinking about what I get out of it. I'm never thinking about what I might contribute to the body. That might be the thing. Could be the wholeness. You might have become more aware today of your preference and maybe the limitations of that. Maybe God is moving you toward a desire for a more holistic worship engagement. Whatever it is, I think there's one step that we can all take, and that is to share that thing with someone. So whichever those categories God is speaking to you in, you could, like right after the service, you could do this. You could just share that with someone. You could ask them to share it with you. You could speak truth to one another. You could pray for each other. You could do all of that in like the 5 minutes right after the service. I actually see that happening every week here and there. I think if it happened across the room, I think it would build up our church in a pretty powerful way. It's not prescriptive. You don't have to do it. There's no points for it, but you can. There's an opportunity to minister to one another. And as we pursue that kind of thing, I just want us to remember, it is not about us. It's not about our gifts. It's about exalting Jesus and building up his body. Let's ask him to move in our body that way.
Thanks for listening to the podcast of Providence Church. For more resources and info, visit us online at www.providenceaustin.com.